Welcome to Gravity, a podcast on the environment and human rights issues from the local to the global.
Our criminal justice system has a pernicious problem. There's no justice within it. After all, our personification of justice is a blind woman wielding a sword, which shouldn't imbue much confidence. Our criminal justice system is also focused on retribution when we need restoration, reconciliation, rehabilitation, and redress. Restorative justice is a victim-centered model that focuses on healing. It seeks to redress the harm caused to the victim and their families by facilitating a dialogue between the victim, the offender, their families, and in cases of wrongful conviction, the wrongfully convicted and their families. It also seeks to address the reasons for the crime and is the best means of providing healing for the victim and their families, as well as illuminating measures to prevent future occurrences. We need to mandate restorative justice as a necessary part of criminal procedure. Our criminal justice system is failing all of us. It is designed to perpetuate criminals and continuing harm to our communities. The United States, the land of the free, has one of the highest rates of incarceration in the world. Our prisoners are a captive labor force who generate over $2 billion in goods and services annually, as incarceration is an exception to the 13th Amendment against slavery. Poor people of color are disproportionately represented because they are systemically targeted by our system, with some communities experiencing the police as an occupying force, and they are effectively denied our constitutional protections. We may parade the importance of innocence over guilt, but we do not practice it. Many people accept convictions because they are faced with a trial penalty if they proceed to trial. This is a double penalty, for they face both trumped up charges and waiting for trial in jail, with more than half of the people in jail today awaiting trial. Our adversarial system produces many errors that lead to wrongful conviction, including eyewitness misidentification, due to the way it is collected and tested and the malleability of our suggestible memories. People with felony convictions become a legal caste who are systemically denied rights and can be discriminated against, designed to navigate them to crime. How does that help our communities? The system fails victims, survivors, and their families too. In cases of sexual assault, both the defendant and the survivor are on trial. Sexism permeates the courtroom. The defense counsel becomes the prosecutor. The jury judges the survivor. What were you wearing? Why were you there at the time? Did you fight enough? Did you cry enough? Did you exhibit enough shame afterward? It's shameful how we treat rape survivors. Some rape survivors are still charged for their rape kits by hospitals, an invasive and traumatizing procedure to collect evidence, even though this is prohibited by the Violence Against Women Act. We still have issues with proper testing and retention of rape kits. We are failing rape survivors. This system is failing all of us. We need to address these systemic failures that are permeated by racism, sexism, and structural violence so we can provide proper redress and restore and repair our communities. In 1984, Bobby Poole raped two women in one night. Jennifer Thompson was attacked at knife point and traumatized, was asked to create a composite picture of her attacker. She was then asked to look at a collection of photos and told she had picked the right guy, which then informed the lineup. Other system errors, permeated by racism, resulted in Ronald Cotton going to jail for 11 years for crimes he never committed. Once he was exonerated by DNA evidence, Jennifer and Ronald met and advocated jointly for better eyewitness collection and wrote a book about their journey of pain and healing, Picking Cotton. I recently interviewed Jennifer about her journey and her advocacy for and assistance to survivors, victims, the wrongfully convicted and their families through her restorative justice organization, Healing Justice. For what is justice without healing? We need to move from retribution to restoration in our criminal system. We need circles of healing, and not just within the criminal justice system, but for our country and for the world, so we can repair harms, strengthen relationships, and free ourselves from hurt for a better tomorrow, together. Welcome to Gravity FM, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you are the founder of Healing Justice, which is an organization that not only works for advocacy to exonerate people and work for victims' rights, or rather survivors' rights in the criminal justice system, but you also have healing retreats and you focus on healing justice, which is restorative justice. Can you tell me a little bit about what restorative justice is?
Sure. Healing Justice is an organization that kind of has two buckets of work. We have our healing side of our work, which is the direct services and peer support in our retreats, and the justice side, which is really helping to teach criminal justice system practitioners on better ways of engaging with and remembering crime survivors and victims in these cases. So restorative justice is an idea. It's very ancient in its origins of kind of victim-centered conversations where it places the victim, the person who's been harmed by something, at the center of what the needs are. And restorative justice has three questions that the victim gets to answer or ask, and that is, how were you harmed? Which is the first question, and all victims and survivors know the answer to that. The second question is, what do you need to heal? What do you need to see to go forward? What do you need to see happen? We generally know what that looks like as well. And that can be a lot to ask of a person who's offended you and hurt you. The third question is, whose obligation is it to do that? Whose obligation is it to do that work? In traditional restorative justice, you have a victim on one end, you have an offender or a defendant or a prisoner on the other end. And that's usually how it works. In wrongful conviction cases, in the space that I work in, there's really not the offender that's placed there, right? Because we know that everybody's been harmed in a wrongful conviction.
Yeah.
It's the victims, survivors, and murder victim family members who were the first people harmed. There's the innocent person who spent decades in prison for something they didn't do, and their family. And so both of those groups are able to answer the question, which is, how were you harmed? And that's something that we do in our circles. Like, how did the wrongful conviction harm you? And where does your grief sit? Where does your loss and longing sit? The second question, what do you need to go forward? What do you need to heal? Many of us don't know, but we do know that sitting in community and safe spaces with people who have survived something similar to you is critical. We get to listen to stories. We get to understand different realities. But the third question of whose obligation is it to fix that? In truth and in theory, the wrongful conviction was caused by the person who created the harm. It's the person who raped my body. It's the person who killed a family member. That's the person who caused it. The secondary person or group of individuals that caused it is the system. It's the legal system who got it wrong, who failed everybody involved. And generally, they're not going to be there in these circles. They have very hard time accepting accountability and responsibility for those. So in the healing justice circles, what that third part looks like is perhaps we can each heal each other and ourselves.
Right, because both the person who is wrongfully convicted and the survivor of the crime, they're both victims of the perpetrator, because if there was no offender, there'd be no system failures in the first place, and then the system failures. And that's a hard one because there's no person that you can imagine. It's usually a conglomerate of people because it's systemic, right? Systemic failures of the system, like how we collect eyewitness testimony, how we have people testify, what evidence the judge decides to put in the courtroom that the jury can see, the trier of fact. If they don't have the right evidence before them, how are they going to make the right decision? It's retaining evidence. Even in Texas right now, it's 5 years they destroy rape kits. 5 years. Whereas right. Most states have 20 or the statute of limitations. And you might even say well, if there's DNA evidence, why do we have a statute of limitations?
Correct. Right. That's exactly right. And it is kind of a myriad of people that are responsible for a wrongful conviction. It's not the crime victim's fault. It's not their responsibility. And it's not the innocent person's fault and their responsibility of why this happened. It is the perpetrator. You know, if I had never been raped that night and the second woman had never been raped that night, Ronald wouldn't have gone to prison for something he didn't do. So at the like base of that, at the core of that, is Bobby Poole, who created all of the harm that night to all of us. But then it's the criminal justice system who, you know, kind of used archaic methods of collecting my memory. It's the system who allowed a police officer to engage in what I would consider corruption. It's the criminal justice system that put things into my mind and told me things that were not true and led me down a path that was wrong.
Yeah.
So it's all of that that is the responsibility of a wrongful conviction. But when we get to a post-conviction, a turning over of a case, and we're sitting there with everyone that's been hurt, you know, we've got murder victim family members who are left with questions and we'll never get the answers they deserve. We've got rape victims who are now being blamed for what happened. And you've got an innocent person and their families who've lost decades with each other. How do we sit in space together and kind of talk about those lived shared experiences that do look very different, but there's lots of common similarities, right? And those similarities look like everybody in the circle's been hurt. Everybody in the circle's lost. And everybody in the circle has trust issues.
Yeah.
So how do you create a space where people can step into to be vulnerable, to tell some of the worst things that have ever happened to them with people that understand, that can build connection with each other, that builds community with each other? And in that space of community, what happens is we create belonging with each other. I see you. You see me.
Yeah.
You've held my story for the last 4 days. I've held your story. We've eaten meals together. We've laughed together. We've cried together. And when we can create belonging with each other, then the healing comes in from that. And that's that third critical part of restorative justice. What do I need? Whose responsibility is it? And we can give that to each other, knowing that the system isn't going to step up.
Right. Sometimes we need the community to be able to feel safe and to be able to heal. We heal together. We need that. And when I look at your circles and all the wonderful things you're doing, I think that actually we need to expand that for the whole nation, because at this point in time, we really need a national circle.
I could not agree with you more. I think where we are as a country, as a people, is that we have forgot how to sit and listen to each other.
Yes.
And find those common threads. One of the things I think about when I go out and I'm kind of among other people is, what is the common thread for all of us? And the common thread is, like, we all love our children. We all need to eat food. We all want to have clean water to drink. We all want a roof over our heads. So there's things that we can start there, right?
Yeah.
And start building spaces of inclusion and belonging. And again, when I think, you know, when we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and there's, you know, food and air and water and safety is in that triangle, one of the pieces of the hierarchy of needs is belonging.
Yes, community. We are losing our sense of community and being divided because we're in these little bubbles. These days, you don't even get a different perspective on the news. You get completely different news.
You do.
My algorithm only tells me this happened yesterday. Your algorithm tells you something else happened yesterday. We're living in increasingly disparate realities, and that takes away from being able to sit and understand each other in the first place, as you were saying, is to listen to each other.
And it's all corrosive. It's all corrosive. But it's not any different than what we see in the criminal justice system and in our court processes. It's how do we divide people out? How do we create a system where there's a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and their jobs are to win. And that is it. It's to win. And it's to win at the expense of truth. It's at the expense of empathy, compassion. It's at the expense of really honestly giving victims what they deserve and need and want. We're not even asked.
Right.
In a criminal justice system, we're not asked what we need. And most victims, and I will tell you, 99% of victims, if you ask them what they need, it's going to be very different than what the court systems are offering.
Yeah.
What's generally not offered is a restorative justice opportunity for victims and survivors. So they're given the option of, okay, nothing, you get nothing, or you get something that's just overly punitive. And at the end of it, at the end of the 30, 40, 50 years, the person who has harmed your family is going to come out and is not going to be a contributing member of society. They're going to be even more broken. They're going to be even more separated. And so,
yes,
you know, one of the things that I think is interesting when we talk about victims and survivors is every victim and survivor will tell you that their primary need is to know that the person who did this to them will never do it to another person.
Right. And when I was reading the book Picking Cotton, which I recommend everybody reads, and I'm looking forward to the film, you talk about how you saw yourself as protecting other women. You really wanted to get the right guy so that this wouldn't happen again, because how could anyone live through that? You're living through it, trying to live through it, and you don't want to cause harm to anybody. And you knew there was another woman that was attacked. You didn't know there were more. In fact, the actual guy that did it, Bobby Poole, he attacked several women.
He attempted to attack a woman before me, and then he attacked me, and then an hour later, he attacked another woman. So two of us in the same night were brutally raped. But then because he wasn't apprehended, he did go on to commit 24 more violent crimes. Right. And so that need
yeah.
that I had, that need to make sure that a violent offender was removed off the streets and didn't, you know, hurt another woman was a failure. So it's the reason why when I talk about wrongful convictions, I talk about it in the terms of it's a bomb that goes off. It's not a bullet. It's a bomb, and it explodes, and anybody within the vicinity of that bomb is going to get shrapnel. It's going to get hurt. And that's what a wrongful conviction is. It's not just me that got hurt. It's not just the second survivor that night that got hurt and our families that got hurt and Ronald Cotton and his family that got hurt, but the whole entire community was harmed because a violent serial rapist was left out in the community for an additional 9 months. And so what we know is that there are hundreds, if not thousands of people that are hurt every time the system fails and there's a wrongful conviction. Because I like to also talk about the harm that's caused to the jurors. Like, I can't imagine being asked to sit in a jury and listen to inadequate testimony, things that aren't true, things that aren't complete, and then render a decision based on the information you've given me. Yeah. Render a decision of guilt. And then pick up the newspaper 25 years later and realize that it was a failure and this person lost, you know, 25 years to a wrongful conviction, and that the victim who the state says, we are here to give you finality and closure, which is a bunch of bull, first of all.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no such thing as closure for crime victims. You don't close hemorrhaging, gaping, festering wounds that live in our bodies forever. You don't close that.
Yeah.
But jurors are hurt. And so in our case, there were two sets of jurors. There were 24 men and women that sat on two trials.
Yeah.
But that now have to sit with themselves and say, oh my God, like, how did that happen?
And we need to actually provide a bit of a narrative as to what happened in the case for people that don't know about Ronald Cotton and the 11 years he spent in prison for a crime he didn't commit, or actually two crimes, right, after the second trial. But in the second trial, there was evidence that he was O positive and that it was blood type A in Mary's home. That is pertinent information for the jury to know. In fact, probably dispositive information that Bobby Poole confessed and he's right there and he matches the blood type and he has a history of violent crime. That's reasonable doubt, I think, for Ronald, if I've ever heard it. And yet the judge said no. So the jury, when they made their verdict, they weren't privy to that information. So they couldn't utilize it. So yeah, if you could give a narrative so that the audience can understand.
Sure. I was 22 years old and living in Burlington, North Carolina. I was a college student and on July 29th had gone to bed early that night, having not felt very well. I'd gotten dehydrated from playing tennis earlier. So I went to bed early and around 3 a.m. I heard a noise in my bedroom, which if you're a woman, you've had these moments where you feel like there's a presence somewhere around you and it's alarming and it's scary and you're not sure if you're making it up or not. And for me at 3 a.m., I heard a noise, but again, you know, you're wondering if you're dreaming it or if you've made it up. And then I noticed a person's head at the left side of my mattress moving. And I said, who is that? And very quickly, a man jumped up and straddled my body. And covered my mouth when I was screaming with a gloved hand and put a knife to the left side of my throat and said, shut up, I'll kill you. And I tell people that when you're in those moments of alarm and you've been asleep and you're not really sure what's happening, you tend to, because the mind wants to, make up a story that you can live with. Such as, this has got to be a joke. This has got to be like some stupid college boy. Like, I don't understand. And I very quickly realized that I was really in danger. And I offered him, you know, my car, you know, can have my credit cards, whatever. Please don't hurt me. And that's when he looked at me and said, I don't want your money. And again, if any woman who's ever been a rape survivor or a sexual assault survivor, which is most of us, knows what's getting ready to happen to you. Like but we also don't know if we're going to die now.
Yeah.
And that was what was happening to my body, is I knew he was going to rape me, but I didn't know if he was going to kill me when he was done. And so I just had this out of body kind of experience that I thought to myself, I won't die here. Like, you may kill me, but not on my back. And so I started trying to figure out how I was going to survive it. And he began to talk to me as he was raping me, and it was clear he'd been in my apartment for quite a while. And he had been drinking because I could smell it. So I just made the decision, for some reason, and I really don't know why, but I told him that I have a fear of knives, and if he'll get off of me and drop the knife on the car, which is at the front of my apartment, that I would let him come back in. And he looked at me really strange and said, really? And I knew that that I had just shifted the power dynamics, because I had to get him off of me. And so I got him off of me, and I was able to manipulate myself in ways to stand close enough to him to figure out how tall he was, how much he weighed, what was he wearing, you know, his facial features, his hairline. I was looking for things like broken teeth or a tattoo or a scar or something that could help me identify him. And when he pretended to drop the knife out, he came back and grabbed me, and I was not going to go back in that bedroom. And so I told him I had to go to the bathroom because I needed some time to think about, kind of next steps, because my plan was to get him out of the apartment, lock the door, call the police. But I didn't know he'd already cut my phone line at that point. And so when I went into the bathroom, I turned the light on to get a glimpse of him and light, because I knew that the police would ask me questions like that. And when I was in the bathroom thinking, I remembered he had said he'd come through the kitchen door. And so my plan was to get to the kitchen door and maybe it was still open and it would give me a quicker exit. So I came out and I told him I had to get some water first, and he told me to make him a drink. And I said, okay. And as I walked towards the kitchen, he was bending down, turning on my stereo, trying to find a radio station, because he thought we were going to have a party. But that stereo emitted a light that I was able to see like a profile of him as I walked by. And again, all these little glimpses of his face were really, really critical for me. And so I went into the kitchen and very quickly turned the lights on, because I knew he wouldn't come in there with the lights on. And I began to make a lot of noise with cabinets and water and ice and just making a lot of noise as I was slowly opening up the back door, and I just started running. And it was raining at this point and it's dark, and I had grabbed a blanket, thankfully, but I didn't know where to go. And I'm not a runner, so I'm not fast. And I looked over my shoulder and he was coming out after me. So I knew that if he caught me that night, that he was going to kill me. So I just did the only thing that to me made any sense, which was I ran to some light, which happened to be a carport on a house that I didn't know who lived there. But I started banging on their door, and the man and his wife who lived there came and looked at me through the glass, and I started screaming. I said, please let me in. I've been raped. He's behind me. He's after me. And she recognized me. She was a professor at the college. And she said, I see her on campus. And they let me in, and I fainted. They called the police. They brought a canine, but because of the rain, they lost his scent. And that's when I would be taken to the hospital for a rape kit. And that's where I would learn that there was now a second survivor, as I could hear her screaming down the hall.
Before we continue to what happened to Ron, still to this day, we're blaming women and shaming them for the worst thing that could possibly happen to a person, because it's hard to, you know, explain also. I don't know. How do you explain something like that to a person that's never experienced it? Taking something that should be intimate and making it so violent, such a violent attack, but also in your soul. Mm-hmm. It's violent in all the ways that it could be violent. And then it's, what were you wearing? What were you doing? Why were you in that area? Or in your book, I wanted to throw the book, why weren't you in bed in a nightgown? Why were you not wearing much? I mean, it's your own home. Meant to be in a safe space. Yeah. I mean,
The defense attorney said that.
Yeah.
And yes, he wanted to know why I'd gone to bed that night in only my underwear. And I remember just looking at him so perplexed, and I fortunately am very quick on my feet. And I said, are you telling me that if he had pulled the covers back and I was laying there in a warm-up suit, he would have said, yeah, never mind. I mean, that's not even logical. And that's not even a thing. The way I try to talk to people, and it really depends, honestly, can I just tell you that most women get it. Most women, and I say most women because not all women. There's many women that are victim blamers as well. I happen to have been birthed by one. But most women understand what that is like and what that feels like for our whole entire lives. That is what we live with from the minute our bodies start developing, that somehow the world looks at us and says, you know, I can take that whenever I want it, that your body does not belong to you anymore. But for many people that are predominantly, and not all men, but many men, when you say the word sexual assault or sexual violence, the only thing they hear is the word sex. They don't hear the word assault. They don't hear the word violent. And I've had many men say things to me such as, yeah, but it's not that bad, right? Because you didn't die, right? Because you weren't hurt, right? So it's not that bad, right? It's just sex you didn't want, right? And so it's very, you know, I think that we've been doing this, obviously, for thousands of years, kind of trying to rationalize violence against women's bodies and blaming women for the violence against our bodies. And part of that, I think, comes again, and why one of the reasons why I fight back on this so hard is because we've also created a sense of shame in those stories. And so women don't talk about what happened to us because the world's told us we shouldn't talk about it. And I am like, I'm like middle finger to that. Heck no. It's like, I'm going to tell you what happened to me. And I actually did a presentation to a very, very, very prestigious, very wealthy high school in Santa Barbara, California, where two young guys came up to me who just graduated, were graduating, going on to college. And they looked at me and they said, you know, I got to tell you that I think you should tone down the way you talk about the rape because it makes me really uncomfortable. And I said, let me tell you something, buddy. I don't care, first of all. If you think that talking about rape makes you uncomfortable, imagine what it felt like to be raped. So if you can't sit with a story and you sit in discomfort about something that happened to my body, I've got nothing else to offer you. Nothing, like literally nothing. I will never not tell my story in the way that I lived it. And that's it. That's it. So one of the things I really think is important is that those of us who are living with these stories inside of our bone marrow talk about what happened to us and who did it to us. And I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's your uncle, if it's a babysitter, if it's the mayor of your town. You need to talk about it and name names.
Mm. Although I suppose it might be easier if you don't know your attacker than if your attacker is somebody in your family or...
I don't know that it's any better, Alexandra. I think it's just really different.
No, I just mean to be able to talk about it.
To be able to talk about it. Yeah, maybe. It's possible. Yeah. No, I think...
It's always tough, but if it's somebody...
Known to you.
Then it's...
Yeah.
And also, it's attacking women for not having the right behavior or safe behavior before an attack. We tend to grade people on how they act after the attack. So it's what were you wearing before, or did you fight enough? People that have never had a gun to their head or a knife to their throat, how can they even imagine what you're thinking, particularly if you're maybe half the size of your offender, right? And then how you react. Some people might just not be able to acknowledge what happened to them for a long time. They might even continue to be best friends with their attacker because their mind doesn't want them to understand that horrible thing that happened. And then we blame that victim. Oh, it took you 6 months to say anything. Oh, the next day you had lunch with the same person and you were laughing. And that seems actually quite rational to me, that you might want to protect yourself in that way to just imagine it never happened because it's the easier thing to do. We're re-traumatizing every survivor in so many different ways. I mean, even the rape kit, we have to do it for evidence, but it is traumatizing in itself. Your body becomes this evidence and then you're prodded for what, hours?
Long time. And in my case, you know, I had to do a second rape kit because the doctor had forgotten to complete it the first time. And so I had to go back and do a second rape kit with a second doctor. And then they billed me a couple weeks later, $500 from the state of North Carolina for the collection of the rape kit. Yeah. I mean, crime victims are just treated so poorly. And of course, I think so much of the way we treat victims and survivors hinges a lot on gender and race. So
yes,
we know that people of color are treated worse. Women are treated worse. Transgender women, Indigenous women, we're treated so poorly.
Yeah, marginalized people are then doubly marginalized when they come to the system. And now if we could just turn to Ron, I know how close you are now, how you can tell the tragedy that happened. His first interaction with the police, Ron went to the police willingly. He willingly went because he was innocent. He decided not to have a lawyer present. Ah! So if you could speak for him in his absence and just tell that part of the story,
yeah,
in the way that you know it and that he's told it with you before.
Well, it sounds alarming to you that somebody would just willingly go to the police department and, you know, waive their right to counsel. But for many of these people in these stories, their mind is, well, yeah, I'll help you because I didn't do anything wrong and I don't need an attorney because I'm not guilty. And so, yes, I will cooperate. And that's a lot of times who ends up becoming a target. They're soft targets for police. They really are. They're just kind of vulnerable, willing people that step into a space and start talking. And where what happened in Ron's case is that, and he wouldn't say anything different than what I'm getting ready to tell you. I mean, we were both young. We were 22 years old. I was in college and Ron was not. And most of Ron's kind of activities would be working and then partying. And he partied a lot. Not that I didn't party a lot, by the way. And so when the police kind of asked him his whereabouts on the specific day and at a specific time, which had been 3 days before, so he went to the police on August 1st. The rape occurred on July 29th. Ron gave a conflicting alibi. He said where he was. They went to get checked out, and his alibi witnesses were like, no, that's not where we were. It's not where I was on that night. And so for the police, that, of course, gets looked at as, well, he's a liar. He's a liar. And by the time he realized where he had been that night, it kind of didn't matter. He'd already set it up. Not intentionally, by the way. This is all happens all the time, particularly when you're scared or nervous or people are asking you questions. And you know, this is 1984. None of us had cell phones or Blackberries, and we weren't, you know, cataloging our whereabouts and photographing our food that has a timestamp in it. We were just kind of out there living life. So that is kind of like what started, I think, the avalanche for Ronald. That was probably the first snowball in the case. And then, of course, when it came to time for me to be asked to look at the photographic lineup and I picked Ronald out, they told me. They were very clear. They were like, that's who we thought it was. He said he was here, but he wasn't there. So we know he's a liar. He's been in trouble with the law before. And for a survivor, a victim who doesn't understand a lot of what happens behind the scenes, I believed to them. And honestly, I'll tell you that Ronald, you know, once the alibi was not corroborated and once the photograph was picked out in a lineup, and anybody will tell you that study this case, they'll tell you that Ron was going to go to prison.
Right, because eyewitness testimony is seen as primary evidence by a jury. What better evidence than that's definitely him? And particularly if you're very confident, right?
And particularly 40 years ago.
And the thing is that the jury doesn't know how the system produces eyewitness testimony and that it's not conducive or at least the way we used to do it, and unfortunately the way we do it in a lot of jurisdictions, but it seems that that was changed to now best practice in this particular jurisdiction where you have double blind administration. Can you tell people a little more about how the eyewitness testimony was produced from the photos to the lineup and how the system navigated you to a false positive.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to know that before the photographic lineup was ever produced, there was a composite sketch done. And so I like to kind of talk about this in chronological order, right? There's the morning of my assault. There's a lot of trauma happening in my body. It's not just, you know, I survived the assault. I've gone through two different rape kits. I'm wearing someone else's clothes in a police department. I have barely survived. I'm terrified. I'm tired. I'm scared. And now I'm being asked to think back in my brain and go through every single part of the human face. So, you know, Jennifer, what did his eyebrows look like? What did his lips look like? What did his nose look like? And back then, this police department used what they called an identikit, which was just a giant file box, and they had tabs of everything that's on your face. So they would pick out, you know, they would have a tab that said shapes of faces, and you'd pick out the shape of face that you remember. And then you start building this composite sketch as if almost like an overlay is what was happening. It was an overlay. And so they put a, you know, set of eyebrows down, and you would go, no, they're bushier, they're straighter, or they're longer, or they're darker, putting together this face. So piece by piece, you're building this composite sketch. And what I didn't know at the time, I do now because I've studied this ad nauseum, is that we are incapable of actually compartmentalizing human faces. I didn't know that, right? That was something that people, you know, that police departments didn't understand. I certainly didn't understand it. When I do a lot of my kind of training on this, what I do ask people about in the audience is I ask them to describe to me the details of your mother's right ear.
Wow.
Exactly. And I don't know how many times you've looked at your mother's ear throughout your lifetime. Millions of times you've looked at your mother's right ear throughout your lifetime. You don't know what your mother's right ear looks like. You just don't. You know what your mother's face looks like. But I promise you, you do not know what her eyelashes look like.
I don't think I could tell.
We can't do it. We can't do it. We just can't. Unless there's something like really obvious about a human face. Like, you know, there's a Harry Potter scar on your forehead. Like that, yes. Mm-hmm. But the average human face, we don't compartmentalize. So I'm being asked to compartmentalize and build this composite. Yeah. And when it was done, the police officer said, does this look like the man who raped you? And the truth was it did, because that's the truth. It looked like, and the people who are listening to this don't know I'm air quoting the word like, looked like. It was a similarity. It was like similar, right?
Yeah.
But the minute that happens, my original memory of the rapist is now erased. And in its place is a composite sketch, because this is the way our brains work. It's not like we're doing anything intentionally or unintentionally. Like the original memory is kind of gone, and there's this new memory, which is a composite sketch, in its place. And so days later, when I'm called to come down and look at a photographic lineup, which was six photographs, three on top of three, what they call a six pack. And I'm given instructions, which, by the way, in 1984, police departments didn't have to give you these instructions. This was kind of a new thing. They said to me, take your time. Don't feel compelled to choose anybody. The suspect may or may not be in there. But I'm 22 and I've gotten a phone call from the police and I'm being asked to come down and look at photographs. And I know in my head, in that six pack is a suspect. I know that. Nobody has to tell me. I just know it. And so as I'm looking through the six photographs and scanning them, what my brain is doing now is not looking for the person who raped me. I'm looking for the composite sketch.
Right.
And the photograph that matches the composite sketch the most is Ronald Cotton. And when I pick his photograph, the police officers say, good job, that's who we thought it was. And that now is called confirmation bias. Yeah. It's like my confidence is out of the roof. I got it right. They told me I did. And now my new memory is Ronald Cotton's photograph. So when I went to the physical lineup a week later to view the physical lineup, and at this point, the police department was undergoing a renovation. So the room that they would have used, which would have had that one-way mirror and protects the witness or victim from being seen, was not being used. And so I was taken to an abandoned schoolhouse to the top floor. And it was me and a folding picnic table and seven men in a lineup. And and once again, I'm given the same instructions, but my brain now is scanning the seven men. And what is it looking for is the photograph. It's looking for the photograph. But again, you don't know this. It's not a conscious thing. It's a subconscious thing. You're just doing it. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote Ronald's number, number five, on a piece of paper, they looked at me and they said, that's who you picked out in the photographic lineup. And so it's important for people to understand that this is how our brains and our memories are so malleable and so prone to suggestion. And by the way, it happens to us every day. When someone says to you, no, you got to turn right to go to the grocery store. And you're like, I just feel like I always go to the left, but maybe this person's right. And you go to the right. And things get put in our brain without our consent all the time. And it changes our memories. And so it does create what you referred to as a false memory. But it's now cemented in my brain, so much so that in 1987, in the second trial, when Bobby Poole is there, I don't recognize him at all.
Right, because you're so confident, your memory has now shifted. When you looked at the photographs, knowing they probably had a suspect in one. And also during the lineup, Bobby Poole wasn't present in either, was he?
No.
Okay. No. It was only years later, 3 years later or something, after your brain had already put the image of Ron in there, right? And the system does this. The Innocence Project, they have helped exonerate so many people, and more than 60%, I think it's 64% or something, of exonerees were wrongfully convicted because of eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony is so fallible. There's estimator variables, like you were saying, it was dark and you only got glimpses. A lot of eyewitness testimony are just glimpses. And then the other issue is how it was collected, the system variables. What is the best process for collecting eyewitness testimony? We know that it might always be fallible, but surely there are ways that we can help prevent mistaken identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I want to say that yes, eyewitness identification can be problematic. It is useful because most crimes are done and caused by people we know. So I don't want people to think that eyewitness identification is always wrong or a problem, because it's not. But what we're talking about here is stranger eyewitness identification, and particularly if you're talking about things such as cross-racial or cross-experiential issues, where, you know, it's someone of different races or different groups that haven't spent a great deal of time with another group. That can be really problematic, as well as weapon focus. And we know that's a problem too. Like, where's the knife? Where's the gun? Am I really looking at your eyebrows? Or am I really trying to figure out, is a gun pointed to my heart or to my brain? So there's things like that that are happening as well. And I do also want to say, because this is really important for people to understand, that no victim, none, zero, zero, no victim wants an innocent person to go to prison.
No.
So it's not like victims that are being traumatized and hurt and harmed are just like, yeah, pin the tail on the donkey, pick somebody, I don't really care. We desperately want the person who hurt us or our families to be held accountable. So, and this is the reason why I'm really, really strong and intentional about this idea of victim blaming. And a lot of this victim blaming has come from not intentional, just not understanding. A lot of this victim blaming has come through the Innocence Projects. and they use a lot of victim blaming language. We've worked with them for over the years, and it's starting to shift some, where we're getting away from saying things such as, you know, white college student falsely accuses an innocent man and sends him to prison. It's like there's everything wrong with that, okay? Because first of all, I can't send anybody to prison. If I had that kind of power, let me tell you, there would be people in prison. I don't have that power. So, you know, I don't have that power. It's the system that's doing this. But the best way to collect an eyewitness account, honestly, is to listen to the person without asking questions, because it's the questions that end up being leading, right?
Right.
When you think about, I'm sitting there interviewing someone who's just been raped or seen someone shot or seen someone, you know, robbed at an ATM machine. Instead of asking things such as, well, did he have blonde hair or could it have been sandy brown hair? At that moment, I'm putting false information into their brain and I'm changing it, right? And so I really do believe the best thing to do when you're collecting someone's memory is just to listen to them talk, because they'll tell you what they remember without you leading them with leading questions. But also just remembering that trauma affects our capacity to encode things. And so talking to me when I am highly traumatized and dysregulated is probably not the time you want to be talking to me. My body is dysregulated. My brain is shutting down, right? This is probably not the best time to get information from me. But then also what you referred to as best practices, North Carolina has been very strong in implementing best practices in the basic law enforcement training manual. And that was led by the detective on our case, who became a true hero in police work, understanding that where he had failed and wanting to be a part of changing that. So this idea of my case, my lineup was done simultaneous, where all six pictures were presented to me at one moment. We know best practices now is sequential, showing a victim or witness one photograph at a time. And I think one of the most important things is the double blind or blind administration, where the person administering this lineup to me does not know who the suspect is and can't give any type of verbal or nonverbal cues.
Good job, you got the right guy. You think, oh, great, I got the right guy.
We're clapping. There's been cases where they're like, yay. The other thing I think is important is the audio and videotaping of these from the beginning to the end. And it shows like how quickly I can identify or how I kind of go, I'm not really sure. Because by the time I get to trial, I've been coached, right? I mean, we get coached before trial. You meet with a DA for dozens of hours before a trial. So I think the audio videotaping is also important. And then, you know, instructing jurors about how memory works. And it's not to say that you shouldn't believe a victim or a witness. It's just you have to understand, like, how does memory actually work? No trial should be based solely on an eyewitness identification. There's got to be other credible pieces of evidence that goes into it, right? It's like, okay, this is who I saw. That can't be it. There also has to be, well, he was found with a gun, or she was wearing the victim's clothing, or there's got to be other pieces of information that corroborate the identification.
Right. When I was reading about this case, wasn't just the problem with eyewitness identification and how it was navigated to a certain result by the police. It was the fact that Ron was known to the police because of something called the trial penalty. We think we have the Sixth Amendment and the right to a jury of our peers, but actually Ron was denied that systemically. He was denied that firstly because he pled guilty or no contest to a crime that he was innocent of, but he didn't want to go to jail for such a long time. And it's like, okay, let me let me take the plea bargain, because otherwise you're in jail and you can't work until you wait for trial. They tell you you're going to lose. You might as well take the plea bargain. Better 6 months over 10 years or something. Mm-hmm. Many cases, there's no trial because people are frightened into it. And it's usually people that don't have access to lawyers mm-hmm. and reliant on the system.
It's absolutely true.
And then when Ron in the book talks about his childhood, he talks about seeing white police officers abusing black children, threatening to kill them if they breathe too hard. And then he had all white juries. At every stage, he faced systemic violence. He faced the structural violence of the system. I'm wondering, the title, Picking Cotton, I know you picked Ron from the lineup, but I just think of the systemic racism mm-hmm. that is still prevalent in this country, unfortunately.
It is. It really is. Ron and I have been talking for that. When the book was being thought about, we would often talk about what would it be like if we ever wrote a book together? Like, isn't that weird? Like, if we ever wrote a book together, isn't that interesting? And then one day I was taking a walk and I had this image in my brain of a white hand coming down into a cotton field, and it was all black cotton. It was like this negative exposure of a photograph. In my creative space, I thought the system is really flipped, right? It's really flipped in that in our country, how racism and structural racism is built into everything systemically, whether it's medical, legal, health, education, it's built into the systems. And so in my head, I thought, what an interesting vision. And I called him and I said, I think I've got the title to this book, right? Like, I explained what I just explained to you. And Ron, who's very, very laid back, was just like, oh, okay, that's cool. That's interesting. I was like, no, but this is really interesting because not only is it like your name, right? Because it's what happened. You know, I picked Ronald Cotton, but it's also this idea that in this country, people of color, people that are poor, the marginalized, the vulnerable, will never get a fair shake in these systems because the systems are designed to fail them, period. And they were built that way. They were literally built and designed that way hundreds of years ago to make sure that people who are vulnerable and marginalized can literally be removed from the streets and you never see them again. And that's it. They're gone. And that's what's happened in our industrial prison system complex, is millions of people are just removed because they're poor or they're black or they're homeless or they're Latino. I mean, they can be taken away and no one knows that they're gone. And so that was kind of the impetus for me in the title of the book. Now, our publisher was very interesting when I went up for a meeting and proposed this book. And they were like, yeah, we like the book. We like this. We like the third person split narrative, blah, 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 blah. I love all of it. But the title, I got a problem with the title. And I was like, really? I was like, you know, what do you have a problem with? And she was like, well, it denotes racism. And I'm like, yeah, I was like, yeah, it does. It doesn't just denote it. It's like screaming it. And I said, if you want the book, you keep the title. And that's just the way it has to be. And so they agreed.
I think it's a brilliant title.
Thank you.
Because it's a personal mm-hmm. story, but the system is the protagonist within it.
And by the way, it's not just that the system is designed to fail marginalized and vulnerable people as defendants, but it's also designed to disregard the bodies of black and brown people when they are victims. So we talk about it a lot, about people that, you know, are in our prison systems are majority are Black and brown. But the majority of victims in this country, rape survivors and murder victims, are also Black and brown skinned people. We have to remember that as well. Like, we're failing everywhere to all of these people. You know, it's, I mean, I could talk about this obviously for days and days and days, but I think it's really important that we talk about the yes and of this, right? It's like, yes, Black and brown skin people are overwhelmingly being overcharged and wrongfully convicted and, you know, overly sentenced. But it's the and Black and brown skin women are the majority of rape survivors in this country. Black and brown skin men are the majority of homicide victims in this country.
Yeah, and they are denied justice too.
All the time.
We need radical systemic changes, which is why we need advocacy for instance, why should we have a statute of limitations if we have DNA evidence? There should be an exemption, right? When we know, oh, it's this person, and you know what? They can just smile and wave and continue on with their lives because they beat it. Ha, ha, ha. No one tested it until it was too late. And then you have innocent people that go to jail because of system failures.
And guilty people who don't.
Guilty people who don't. And you have survivors being traumatized in an exoneration. That's also a third trauma, right? Because the first trauma is the actual attack. The second trauma is the system. You're testifying and having to relive what happened in front of all these strangers, and then you're attacked for your behavior with the defense trying to poke holes because they're trying to win, right? It's that trauma again. And then the third trauma is understanding that you thought you were safe all these years, but there's somebody out there, and an innocent person went to jail, and you were unwittingly part of it. The system has failed everybody.
But there's a fourth trauma that most people don't really understand, and that is particularly a rape survivor, but also many of our murder victim family members who have had a loved one brutally removed, we get blamed for what happened. And so after Ronald was exonerated, and I decided that I would become an advocate and an activist in this kind of part of the system, trying to do what I could to ameliorate, you know, the damages and educate people on the complexities of eyewitness identification. I got brutalized by the public and by the media. And I was asked for I was asked to carry a narrative and a blame for something that was not mine to carry. I was asked to carry a story that wasn't my story. And that was the story people wanted to foist on me, that I was just like some racist white Southern girl who just didn't care, who went to prison. And I was out there intentionally trying to wrongfully identify an innocent Black man, which it's absolutely false. Not one piece of that is true, with the exception of I am white and Ron is Black, but so is Bobby Poole. Mm. And so that narrative was false. And I will tell you that in all the times I've ever done a presentation, in all the audiences and the thousands and thousands and thousands of people I've spoken in front of, not one single person has ever raised their hand and say, my God, Bobby Poole did all of this to all of you. That's never what people say. It's what people always say is, oh my God, how do you live with yourself, Jennifer? And I'm thinking, I did the very best I could. I tried my best. I'm still trying my best. And so that trauma that you speak of is ongoing forever and ever and ever till the end of time.
Yeah. I think part of the reason that you have, I'm speculating, but that you have faced these attacks, which I'm sorry to hear that you have. And I'm very frightened about this, actually, that we are losing the ability to critically think, and maybe we don't have the space for it. This is why I think the circle is needed for our country, because we're increasingly on sides, right? We see everything in a very dichotomous binary fashion. We want to blame people. It's easy. Let's not blame the system because we don't know how to navigate that. It's easy to say, okay, in this story, this person is right and this person must therefore be wrong because I have to pick sides. I have to be on the side of the good, not understanding that there's nuance and no malice. You were trying to protect people and you were navigated by the police who kept confirming, and it wasn't just your testimony that put Ron in prison. There were numerous systemic failures. I'm very worried about this, that people like to see things in binaries.
No, I think you're right. Again, I talk about life in general in the yes and space. It's that. It's like two things can be true, right? Two things can be true. We can hold space for all of it, to be honest with you. And I think, again, we've lost the ability to sit in space with each other and listen to lived experiences of other people. Because I think it's so much easier for the vast majority of us out there is just to render a judgment based on a limited amount of information. Because honestly, it's kind of lazy. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of lazy thinking. And I think it's why when I do the work that I do, that I think it's so important that we talk about these stories in entirety. One of the things that I think that's happened, particularly in the wrongful conviction space for 40 years, is we've talked about these stories from the perspective of the wrongfully convicted person. If you read any of the stories in the newspaper, you don't know anything about what happened to the victim. You might say 19-year-old, you know, was shot in a car, but you don't know that 19-year-old was getting ready to go to college or was in love with, you know, the next door neighbor or had hopes of opening their own business or loved dogs and, you know, liked to walk. I mean, you don't know anything about this person. And so what's happening is we're hearing a partial story.
Yeah.
And we're not hearing the total story. And it's why at Healing Justice, we talk about creating equity in stories, equity in the narrative. Because if we're going to truly do meaningful reforms, if that's what we're interested in, and if we really want to do criminal justice reform, and it means something, we have to hear the stories of everybody impacted.
Yeah.
Everybody. You have to hear the story about the little girl who loses her mother, who's kidnapped as she's waving goodbye and never sees her mother again because she's kidnapped and tortured and murdered. You need to hear about the mother who's holding her 5-year-old son with a bullet in his head, and they've kept him alive long enough for her to cradle him and say goodbye. You have to hear that part. You have to hear that. It's not enough for you to hear the story of somebody spent 24 years in prison for something they didn't do. And that's a terrible story. But we also need to hear the story of the 8-year-old who someone broke into her home and raped and sodomized her while her parents were sleeping down the hallway. You have to hear that. You also have to hear about the other people who we call like the secondary victims, the people who were hurt because the wrong person went to prison and the guilty person stayed out in the street. Like if we're going to really make system changes, you have to hear all of it. And guess what? It's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it makes us feel like garbage. It should make us feel like garbage. We should hear these stories. These people lived. And it's like with school shootings, like, you know, you don't know any of the victims' names from Columbine, but you sure know who the two guys who were killed all those people. You don't, like, we need to hear the stories of the people who've been impacted initially. So I think, you know, when we talk about, like, what do we do going forward? how to create momentum to really create the changes that I think most of us actually want to see is we have to sit down and listen to each other. And we have to listen to those experiences that got us here. That's the only way we shift this. It really is.
Right. Listening to uncomfortable narratives. So in your book, you talk about how you volunteered with an organization, Stop Child Abuse Now, and how you realize that even your offender was in a cycle, probably, of abuse because you never got the chance to talk to him. As a society that sits to listen to repair, how do we stop this cycle of abuse? Because babies aren't abusers.
No, no.
It's society that makes them that way. They're neglected as children and so forth. And if we don't also look at the offender's narrative and try to empathize and see how do we resolve that? At what critical juncture can we come in and rehabilitate this narrative so that we don't have to repeat these acts ever again, so they don't exist?
Well, it's a good question. I think you alluded to it when you said society. Now, this is my perspective, so I'm not trying to suggest everybody should feel the way I do. But I do believe that as a person who lives in society, that it is incumbent on me to care about the community around me. That I've worked with people who have actually committed the crimes, and they'll stay in prison for the rest of their lives. And I've listened to their stories of their origin stories of being a child and living in communities and families of drug addiction or violence or poverty, any number of those things. And as someone who lives in society, going back to this thing where I volunteered with Stop Child Abuse Now, that was my impetus, right? It was like, if I can go in there and tell some five-year-old that you are valuable and worthy and deserving and help that mother or father understand how to parent, and I can reparent the parent who was also a broken child. If I can be, a catalyst for that type of change, then I have literally like changed society, right? Like,
yeah.
I've changed that. We can do it. All of us can do it. Every single person can do that. We all can do it. We all have the power to do it. We all have the power to get involved in any organization that's meaningful for us to help create changes within that community. But I think so many of us, people who look like me, have been given, we were born on third base. It's not hard for me to make a home run. I was born in a family that went to college. I was born in a family that had, it was middle income. I was born in a family that traveled. I was born in a family where mom and dad loved each other. I was born in a family where there was no physical sexual abuse happening. Like, I didn't do anything to deserve that. Just happened. That just happened. I'm not a better person. I just got born that way. Conversely, there's people that are born in the dugout. There's people that are born out in the parking lot. They're never going to be able to make a home run. And again, not from anything that they ever did. They're a child born into circumstances that are beyond their control. And so how do we as a culture and as a society like understand that and create ways of building up community, of investing in community, of creating opportunities where everybody can succeed? And it's not hard to do, by the way. This is not, doesn't take some brilliant Einstein to figure this out. It's like, we just equip people with decent food to eat and educational opportunities, and moms can go to work because there's daycare provided and people are afforded access to health care. It's very possible to do.
Yes. And it's a shame and it's embarrassing that we don't do that in this country, right? think that we will get there, though. I have hope for this country.
I have hope because I think that we have a different set of youth that are coming up that are seeing things differently than my generation did. But I will tell you that I hear a lot from a lot of people that look like me that think somehow they're just deserving more because they were born in the skin they were born in. And I'm very vocal about this. I don't try to mince words about it, but if you were born on third base, I'm not going to applaud you for, you know, getting a walk to home run. Like,
yeah,
that was easy. I want everybody to have the same access to the same things I do.
Yeah, me too.
No matter what.
That is just respecting common equal dignity, which we all have. And I'm a big fan of etymology, and I find it instructive to look at where does the word community come from? It comes from two Latin words, right, smashed together. One is with, and the other is obligation. So a community is when we understand that we have obligations to each other. Instead of focusing on rights and what we can extract from each other, it's actually our common obligation, our duty to help each other. And that is society too, right? That's fraternity. I mean, of course, fraternity is very masculine, but that we're siblings. We're all together. To understand that, we need to listen to each other, just like in the circle that you do with everybody understanding they're conjoined in this universal tragedy of the system that has abused everyone. We've talked a lot about the system, but I want to just go back to the personal side of things. I understand what you're writing here, and also what Ron's writing is that you both realize that forgiveness was something that was empowering and rehabilitating to you personally. Because Ron's not here, if I may just read a few words from the book.
Sure.
I had had 11 years to think about what had happened to me, years in prison where I made a decision to let go of the anger and frustration. Since I had gotten out, I went twice a week to Hester Grove Baptist Church and came to feel that God had given me a second chance at life, a chance to really make something of myself, and I could only go forward. Anger would have just kept me stuck as if I'd never left prison. And so for Ron, he realized that, as I'm understanding, that it was something he needed to move on because otherwise it was like this malignant cancer. And then for you, when you wrote the letter to Bobby to ask him to meet in person and he never responded, right, was that also trying to overcome and to let go?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think my journey into that world took some time, just like it did with Ronald. Ronald had 11 years knowing he did not commit the crime. When he came out, like I now had to readjust, you know. So my healing forgiveness journey took several steps. I mean, the first, of course, was meeting with Ronald and sharing our questions and information and fear and loss and grief with each other that day in the church. But then, yes, it was writing to Bobby Poole. And I now look back on it, and I'm not sure that I mean, I think there's a space in there of forgiveness of Bobby Poole, but it really looks less to me like forgiveness and more of acceptance and surrender. Of knowing that if I stayed angry and hateful and bitter, then effectively he would have killed me that night and destroyed me. And I just didn't want to give it the power. And so for me, it was about taking back my power and finding my voice and creating my own agency, which has taken me some time, you know, to be able to tell my story in the way that makes sense for me and the way that I lived it. And so sometimes I get pushback on the word forgiveness, and I get that. Like, I have survivors will look at me and say, I will never forgive the person who killed my wife or who, you know, who raped me. And I'm like, you don't ever have to. You don't ever have to. And I think that's one of the words that, you know, kind of like the word love, we've overused it and that we've kind of diluted it.
Yeah.
I think what I strive for and what I would encourage anybody who's struggling with wounds that were created is how do you not give your power away anymore? And for Jennifer Thompson, power looks like joy and happiness and love and laughter and movement and hiking. That's, for me, it means that you don't get to have that.
Hmm.
You thought you did, but you don't.
Yeah.
And that's, so for me, I think when I talk about it, particularly with the groups that I work with, it's really not about forgiveness. And I wouldn't ever ask somebody to forgive. I just wouldn't do it because you don't ever have to. But I do think if we're going to individually and collectively move in a direction that is compassion and kind and loving, I think we do have to talk about what adds value to your life and what takes value away.
And in the circles that you do in the Healing Justice retreats with everyone in the physical circle, but also in the circle of the tragedy, the different experiences, how do you see people coming together and together being able to heal?
It is a process. It is not something we just jump into the circle and start talking. It has to be set up really, really well. And it has to be set up beforehand. So, you know, making sure that you have participants who can sit in discomfort, who can sit with different stories. So that has to be created in a way that is safe, because you don't want to create a healing circle that creates harm. So kind of the beginning work is very important, making sure that people understand what they're stepping into, what they're not stepping into. This is not counseling. This is not a retreat where you're going to get your nails done. This is a hard work, 4 days, 3 nights of listening to stories that are really hard to listen to. So you have to do the kind of preparation ahead of time, make sure that people are aware. And then when we get into circle, you have to do it in layers. And so we establish guidelines and values that we all are bringing into the circle. Everybody has to build consensus on that. Everybody has to agree that we're talking in honesty, that we're speaking with respect, that we're staying present. So that has to be done really well. And then you start building in activities that start regaining some trust with the other people in the circle. Also allowing people to slowly open, you know, you don't want to quickly unzip people. You have to like slowly let people kind of step into that and feel it. But we also build in a lot of other activities that bring joy in. So we always do an expressive arts project. At each retreat, there is a project that everybody does that helps graphically illustrate a topic, such as we do a shoe project where they choose a pair of shoes. I've got hundreds of them that I've collected, and the shoes represent what were the shoes you wore, and they create the road they walked on, and it's using color and material and textures to create something that I need to explain to people through a visual representation. And then we talk about it on our last day. So they work on this together in groups. You know, they sit up at night till 2 a.m. sometimes doing their art. It allows them to have these kind of free form conversations, which is really important in building community. But on our last night together, we do improvisational games where everybody's kind of an 8-year-old and being ridiculous and silly. And there's something really magical about watching a rape survivor play a really silly game in this circle with someone who was convicted of raping a child. and they laugh together and they trust each other to bounce, you know, the stuff off of each other. That's really healing. You know, art is healing. Laughter's healing. Like it's all healing. And when you do it in group, in space, it's particularly healing. And then we end our retreats with the showing of our art project, telling people what we're trying to articulate. And then we, our last thing we do together is a gratitude ceremony together, where people express gratitude for an individual or, and it's, so it's all done very specifically and then very intentionally. It's a program we've created, that works, and but it takes time, and our participants can come once to a retreat and feel like that's great. They can come back five times to retreats and keep building.
Oh, that's wonderful, and it's unique.
Yeah, we're the only ones doing it. We're the only organization in the country. We've been here 11 years, and we're the only ones doing this work with everyone impacted.
Really important work, because the criminal justice system, that's not healing justice. That's not transformative. It's not restorative. It's not rehabilitative. We've covered a lot of issues today, and I see that we've gone over, so thank you for allowing that extra time. But is there anything that you really wanted to say that we haven't covered?
Yeah, I think the thing, we've covered it, by the way, but the thing I want to just kind of keep driving home is this idea about blaming victims and survivors. It was not my job to solve the crime. It wasn't. And it's the victims are not responsible for solving the crime against their bodies or their loved ones. And so I'm hoping that the listeners understand that and become more curious about the whole story that they are reading and they're listening to when the news comes on or the newspaper hits their front porch, if papers even hit front porches anymore. but it's, I think it's just really important that we ask really bigger questions.
Right. And if there's the call to action for the audience, apart from asking bigger questions, is there anything from all the work that you've done and your personal experience that you could see that we don't have the policy we need to change? Call your local representative and say, we need this.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if I was going to suggest anything, it would be demanding that restorative justice become part of the criminal justice system process as an offering to victims.
Oh, yeah. And that it be free, just like mandated settlement.
Yep.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your courage, your resilience, your compassion, and the community that you are fostering for people that really need to heal and have not been able to do so. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Alexandra. I really appreciate you.
I hope you have found this podcast insightful and will join us next time as we explore more issues affecting our environment and human rights at home and around the world. For more materials on this issue, please go to our website, thegravity.fm.